and welcome to the RI Science Podcast. How did societies develop across the globe, and how did gender become so enmeshed in them? In this episode, we go a little beyond our regular science programming to join award-winning science journalist Angela Saini in conversation with former Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard. By looking at cultures throughout human history and in the modern day, they overturn simplistic theories to show that what patriarchy is and how far back it goes really depends on where you live. This conversation and Q&A was recorded from our theatre at the Royal Institution on the 2nd of March 2023. If you'd like to join yourself, you can get tickets to our upcoming talks and live streams. Head to rigb.org. And now, over to the theatre.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Royal Institution. My name is Catherine Matheson. I'm director here at the Royal Institution, and I think there's a number of people for whom it's your first time in this very special theatre. Is there anyone who's here for the first time? So, yeah, loads of people. You are all extremely welcome. I'm delighted to welcome you into this space. As some of you may know, the Royal Institution is a place where we bring together writers, researchers, scientists, and give you the opportunity to hear directly from them about the amazing work that they're doing. And tonight's event is one that I'm particularly delighted about, and I think we have a treat in store. I think we're going to hear from a couple of really wise and insightful people, and it will change the way that we see the world. So I'm really looking forward to it. So if you would join me in welcoming our speakers, Julia Gillard and Angela Saini.
Well, that was a wonderful introduction. We both turned to each other and said, no pressure now. We've been introduced as women of wisdom. We will do our best. But we are here to launch Angela's wonderful book. So I'm going to ask Angela some questions about it. But let me start, Angela, by inviting you to say a few things about yourself. You live in New York now, but London was your original home. Can you tell us about where you grew up and your perspective on this great city?
I still love London. I am going to come back here to live. But the patriarchs really came out of previous work that I've done. The reason I became a journalist in the first place is because I was born in East London, but when I was around 9 or 10 years old, my parents moved to a part of South East London at that time was a very active area for the far right. So the British National Party, which was the big far right party at the time, had its headquarters in the same town as my school. There were a number of racist murders, including Stephen Lawrence's, which is the most famous one, but there were others. And that's when I started becoming active in anti-racist politics. And when I went to university, I started writing for the first time on these issues. And if I hadn't done that, because I was studying engineering, I would have become an engineer. But I went into journalism instead. And I did everyday reporting for the first 10 or so years of my career. I was just doing politics and crime and everything. And when I came to science, what I wanted to do was treat it as a beat in the same way that a political reporter treats politics, not as, you know, something they're just describing, but something they're investigating and interrogating. For me, science is a system of power, like any other system of power, as well as offering us truths about the world. It also shapes how we feel about ourselves and others, and that gives it tremendous influence over how we think and how we live. And my work has really been about that. My last two books, Inferior and Superior, were about asking where has science got things wrong and why, because of the politics there. And with the patriarchs, I've gone more into history, if I'm honest. I don't want to disappoint everyone who thinks they've come to a science talk. This is still a science talk. But science can help us answer some of these questions about male domination and how it arose. But I think also, obviously, we need to look at culture, anthropology, archaeology, and the history to understand those big questions. And that's where my work is going now.
And let's just talk a little bit about your first two books. You referred to them as Inferior and Superior. It's Inferior, How Science Got Women Wrong, and Superior, The Return of Race. And you've talked broadly about the biologising of identity. Can you explain to us what you mean by that and how that relates to the material you canvassed in those books?
Well, I think everywhere in the world, wherever you get a hierarchy between people, sooner or later, often that hierarchy will be framed as natural by those in power because it suits them to be able to say that we are just better and that's why this inequality exists. And you get that with every form of oppression, racial, caste, class, everything, and gender depression. And this is where science can be useful, because when people make those biological or naturalistic claims to power, then we should be able to say, well, actually, what proof do you have for that? What actually does the science say about those claims? And clearly, because these are social systems and political systems, the biology does not tally with them. But that point needs to keep being made again and again, because there are enough people who are invested in selling us the idea that they're not.
Now, this book is a truly remarkable one. I was privileged to get a pre-release copy and to read it, and it's a huge sweep through time and place, looking at patriarchy and on the search for answering the question how men came to rule. And so I want us to talk about the contents of this book, and to do that by me putting to you some questions which I think might well be on people's minds generally. If you said to people, why is it that we have patriarchy, that we have women's oppression, that there's still things for feminism to fight for, I think, you know, many people would come up with snapshot answers to that. And a snapshot answer might be, well, you know, if we look across the broad sweep of human history back hundreds of thousands of years, on average, men were able to project more physical force than women. That put them in a more powerful position than women. And as societies came to settle, those pre-existing gender relations settled in those societal structures. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
No.
No? Okay. This is the first of many errors I'm going to make tonight to get Angela to talk about what's in the book. Many people would think that, though.
Yeah, they do.
It's got an intuitive kind of, I guess so.
That makes sense to people, you know, that there's an average size difference between men and women, and average difference in upper body strength, and surely that explains why things look the way they do. And that is, you know, a very easy thing to jump to. But history doesn't show that that is necessarily meaningful, because the further back you go in history, you don't see huge gender differences in how people live and in how power is allocated. Certainly in prehistory, so one of the places that I went to when I was researching the patriarchs was Çatalhöyük, which is this beautiful settlement in Anatolia, 9,000 years old, which means it's older than the pyramids, it's older than Stonehenge, it's older than Harappa. And this is pre-writing, so we can't know exactly how people lived. But what we can see from all the archaeological data that we have, all the ways that we have to measure gender difference between how people lived, that men and women lived pretty much the same lives, that they spent the same amount of time indoors, that they were doing roughly the same things. The size difference between them was fairly slight, so they weren't eating differently. We see female figurines everywhere in this period of history. So it's not as though women were invisible either. Now, we can't know how people felt or how they organized themselves necessarily from that. What we can know is that for every measure we have, this was not a particularly gendered society. And what does that tell us? That prehistory was not perhaps as patriarchal as we are now or as some societies are. And we also know from cultural evidence, there are loads of societies even now all over the world which are matrilineal, which organise themselves very differently from patrilineal and patrilocal societies. And I'll just explain very quickly. Matrilineal means that name and property is passed from mother to daughter rather than from father to son. And matrilocal means that people tend to live with their mother's family. So even after a woman gets married, if she gets married, then she will stay with her mother's family and her husband will either come to her or he will live elsewhere with his own mother's family. So given that we have all this counter evidence, all these, you know, other societies living the way they do, if there were a natural rule, if there were only one way for us to live, then wouldn't we all be living that way now? Why is it that throughout history and even into the present, we see so much variation? Now, one, if you do want to turn to biology and if you do want to look, for example, at other primates and how they organize themselves, certainly in the 20th century, people thought that we must be male-dominated. And when they looked at chimpanzees, which are one of the closest relatives to us genetically, they saw that they are also male-dominated. So maybe that tells us something about our evolutionary past. But then, in the last few decades, it's become clear that the other closest species to us genetically, the bonobo, is female-dominated. And there is also an average size difference between bonobo males and females. The difference is that bonobo females form very strong bonds between other females, even those that aren't kin, and that just makes it impossible for males to rise up that hierarchy. So the older females have the most authority and the most power. And the males
could be a lesson in that.
There could be a lesson, yeah. I don't know why we don't follow that lesson, to be honest. So, you know, there is very little in the evidence that we have that tells us that this power differential or this kind of physical differential, which again is on average, and if it were just that, then why is it that older men are the ones in power generally, who are not necessarily the most powerful of all of us? You know, why them then? So there are lots of holes in this. And what I'm trying to do is get people to ask questions. I'm not ditching any explanation. What I'm saying is that is one way. The biology is one way to explain it if you want to. But let's just imagine that isn't the reason. How else can we explain everything that we see?
Okay, let me try a few more on you. That first one hasn't gone particularly well. You talk in the book and about there being, and you've referred to one, societies where there appeared to be little difference between the way in which men and women lived their lives, and there were women on figurines and the pottery and ornaments that remain to us. And that did give rise to a theory that there were many matriarchal societies that ultimately got overwhelmed by militaristic invaders. Yeah. So people were living this kind of societal life, and then as we saw in human history, people come from different places to take over, and that being predominantly done by men going to war, men projecting force, that disrupted and changed the natures of those societies. Let me try that one on you. Am I doing any better?
You know where this is going.
I do know where this is going, but it was a very popular theory for a long time.
It was, yeah. So, when I started writing this book, obviously the first thing I did was look at other literature in this area. What other books do we have explaining the origins of patriarchy? And what's truly surprising is that there's very little. In fact, the last proper book on this topic was Gerda Lerner's, which is a historian, The Creation of Patriarchy, which is about as old as I am. And we have learned so much more since then. In fact, a lot of history has been rewritten since then based on what we know about gender. The first time this was a really big question, at least in European intellectual circles, was in the 19th century. So in the middle of the 19th century, people were fascinated by this question of how did patriarchy come about? How did societies come to be male-dominated? Because there were revolutions happening, women were fighting for their rights. And in the US, settler colonists who were trying to build what they imagined to be the forefront of a new society. This would be the most modern society on the planet, one built on the principle of equality. And what they were astounded to find was that indigenous Native American societies, like the Haudenosaunee, who were in New York, which is the story that I cover in The Patriarchs, already had very egalitarian societies, very egalitarian ways of dividing up work, in which women had a huge deal of authority and a lot of power, and always had. And they couldn't square that circle. They just couldn't figure out how it was that what looked to be an ancient society could be more egalitarian and forward-looking than the society that they were trying to build. And the way they squared that circle was to say that primitive societies, because they're deemed this primitive, were matriarchal, and that patriarchy was kind of a modern invention, inevitably, that came out of men realizing that they should have power and then taking control of women. And so this became framed as a kind of primitive versus modern, which is obviously a really racist way of looking at that kind of history. But that stuck. Even into the 1970s and 1980s, you can read in feminist literature this idea that we were all matriarchal once and that we became patriarchal later, as though modernity requires you to become patriarchal, when in fact, in the Americas at least, it was settler colonialists and Christian missionaries imposing their ideas of patriarchy on societies that had always had been matrilineal and given women lots of power to begin with.
And you talk in the book about other examples of the impact of colonial bringing of their version of patriarchy and the imposition. Can you talk to us about some other examples of that and some of the ways that those societies tried to keep to their own systems and how successful that struggle was in the face of the sort of colonial oppression and colonial dominance about how things should be done?
So I imagine a lot of people will be wondering, how old is patriarchy then? If it was invented at some point and then spread, then how old is it? Well, it really depends on where you are in the world. So certainly in Europe, we can say it's thousands of years old, because we see in, for example, ancient Greece and Rome, and even in ancient Mesopotamia, Assyria, you can see the development of these gendered rules and norms, which then shape institutions of marriage and how, you know, create the societies that we now recognize. But in other parts of the world, it is within living memory. So I only have one illustration in the patriarchs, that's this matrilineal map. And if you look at these existing matrilineal societies, they are everywhere except Europe. So you can see them in Asia, across the Americas, a huge matrilineal belt in Africa. And each one of these matrilineal societies is different in its own way. The reason patriarchal societies look as homogeneous as they do is partly because they are a product of conquest and colonization, not just European colonization, I have to add. These are empires way predating that. But, you know, through religion, through politics, through sheer power of, you know, the force of empire, these ideas were spread. And they skew this kind of understanding that we now have. Because they're so common, we think this must be the norm, and that the matrilineal societies are somehow odd and weird. I think the more interesting question to ask is, why is patriarchy so common? That's the most weird thing. That of all the kind of rainbow of ways we could choose to live, this one in particular has become so widespread.
And the answer?
Well, that's what the whole book is trying to answer. There are lots of there are loads of different factors, and it really depends on the time and the place. So, for example, if you look in Kerala, Kerala is a state, southern state in India, which is very famous in India, and you know they sometimes call it the matriarchal state, which is an overstatement, but certainly literacy rates among women and men are almost the same and very, very high in Kerala and always have been. Women have a lot more agency. It's a lot easier as a woman to travel in Kerala than it is in other parts of the country. And Kerala has its own matrilineal traditions. Now, during the 19th and 20th centuries, we have it so well documented, both by outsiders and insiders, this history of how very slowly Christian missionaries and the British Empire slowly undermined women's authority legally over time, where women were in charge of their households, slowly they legally began transferring that power to men. That where there was a queen, they would say, no, you can't be in charge, your son has to take power. And these kind of small changes that together with men in these communities traveling outside of the state, seeing how it was elsewhere and thinking, well, we could live that way. Why are we living this way? So these cultural changes combined with the way that matrilineal had been framed by outsiders as somehow backward, that you are not living in a modern way, took its toll. It took 200 years. It was only in 1976 that matrilineal, kind of the final blow was delivered legally. It was abolished. So this is after the end of colonial rule in India. So tracing that history, what do you learn? You learn that if throughout history, when social change happens, does it happen in this big catastrophic way? Not usually. Very rarely does it happen that way. It happens gradually through social norms changing, the politics changing, the balance of power shifting. And if we can document it within our own time, then surely we should be able to understand that throughout history it would have taken a very similar route. And it really depends on then, on where you are and what the circumstances are.
And in terms of where you are and what the circumstances are, the rise of nation states, of how they chose to organise themselves, how we still choose to organise ourselves, if choose is the right word in that sentence. Can you talk to us about how much that matters and whether there's evidence of nation states deliberately changing social norms either towards more patriarchy or towards more equality?
Well, what we definitely see is, you know, often in feminist literature, when we talk about patriarchy, we talk about the rule of the father. In fact, that's literally what it means, patriarchy, rule of the father. And so we imagine that this form of oppression started in the family and then radiates outwards. And I argue the opposite, because when you look historically, if it had started in the family, if this was a rule within the family, then we would see a lot more, we would see it pretty much the same everywhere in the world. And we don't. Gendered oppression comes after the development of agriculture. So agriculture is around for a very long time before anything happens, before anything changes. But what you do see is with the development of the first states, the rise of these early states in ancient Mesopotamia, you see what is the state's main preoccupation? Its population. How do you, when you are developing these entities, in order for the most powerful, the elite of your society, to live a better life, how do you get people to stay and keep having children and then stay loyal to the state so you don't leave? That is a huge issue for them. And this makes gender and, you know, the family interesting to the state, because it needs people to have more babies and it needs people to be able to go out and fight and defend the state. And so the way they do this is by imposing these rules around how you can behave, that young women should be having more children, that families should be offering up their young sons to fight if they need to, whether or not, as individuals, you want to or can do either of those things, doesn't matter. The point is the state needs you to fulfill those obligations. And so that's where you get the institution of these really rigid kind of binary delineations that say, this is how you behave in this group, and this is how you behave in this group, and this is how you behave as a family. So I would argue that the state then imposed these rules on the family. And actually, you can see in the literature, families fighting back. Men saying, oh, I don't want everything to go to my son when I die, or I don't have a son from everything to go to, so I'm going to designate my daughter as a son, and then she can inherit everything. So trying to find loopholes that they can exploit in order to be able to live the way they actually are, because as we know, as individuals, we're all different. Not every woman wants to or can have children, not every man wants to or can fight. But that, what gender depression tells you is that's what's required of you.
I'm going to take you now to more modern iterations of nation states, and particularly to an argument about the role of the washing machine. Can you talk to us about that?
So this is a good segue from what I just said. When can we look in history and see a state turning its back on patriarchy? You know, the first real attempt to smash the patriarchy. And we see that in the 20th century with the Bolshevik Revolution. The Soviet Union was the first country on earth to legalize abortion. That was in 1920. And very early on, and I don't want to, you know, I don't want to anyone to think that I'm somehow condoning the horrible, authoritarian, brutal nature of these regimes, but at the very beginning of the Soviet Union, there was this understanding that gender equality, at least nominally, has to be part of what we're doing, that we are trying to achieve the end of social inequality between people, and gender has to be part of that. So very quickly, they brought in not just rules around new legislation around abortion, but also opening up education to everybody, all men and all women, opening up jobs to everyone, that women were expected to work and often work in the same jobs that men were working in. In certain socialist states in Eastern and Central Europe, later they brought in childcare, kind of ample childcare. One of the women I interviewed who lived in Hungary through before the collapse of the Soviet Union said that when she grew up in Budapest, her parents both worked, which was just expected because all men and women worked, but she never remembered her mum cooking. And that was because the work canteens would give them their food, and then they would just make a sandwich in the evening when they got home, or they would bring home, food home. And there were public laundries. They took their linens to the public laundry and they would do it for very, very cheap, and then they would bring it home. So here we see, within a generation, or maybe two generations, gender norms being completely changed in these societies. The mark is still there. Look at the rates of women in STEM in Eastern Europe. They are much higher than elsewhere in the world. The number of women sent to, number of girls sent to the science Olympiads is much higher. Women chess champions. You look at every measure, there is far more of this of these remnants of gender equity in these former socialist states. And we've kind of erased that history. We don't like to remember it because of the horrible stuff, you know, the awful. And again, I'm not whitewashing it. It was horrific, and people did not want to live under those regimes, including women. Many women turned their backs on this. But what they did, we have to be able to look at and ask, why did this work and how did it work?
And the washing machine?
The washing machine, sorry, I completely sidestepped your question. So, the washing machine question. There is a very famous debate that happened between Nikita Khrushchev and Richard Nixon in the 1960s, I think, or 1950s, I'm trying to reach back into my memory, sorry, called the kitchen debate. And Nixon was showing Khrushchev this kind of model American home. It had a front-loading washing machine, and Nixon was saying, look how easy we make the lives of our women in America. And Khrushchev turned around and said, well, in the Soviet Union, we don't treat our women like slaves just to be stay at home and do domestic work. And this was very interesting, because you can see these two very powerful men kind of having this debate over what women want. And they were both right in a way, and they were both wrong in a way, because we all want front-loading washing machines too, but we also want to be able to work. All of us, you know, the men and the women. But this kind of summarized the ideological debate that was happening at the time. When we think of the Cold War, the gender question was a huge part of that. And in some ways, the lag that America took in instituting men, much of its gender rights legislation, including Roe v. Wade, was partly because, I think, it took such a hardline position against the Soviet Union, and anything associated with women's rights became also associated with socialism. So it became very difficult then for the US to give any ground politically to women's rights activists, because to give ground would be to say that maybe the Soviet Union had it right. They were really anxious about this. You can see this. There were interviews done of Russian exiles by Harvard University professors, Harvard University researchers, and again they keep asking these people who have left Russia, what was it like for women? you know, how are women treated? And again, these people saying, we want to leave, but actually, yeah, women did have a lot of gender equality. Yes, you know, I was a chemistry professor and it was, you know, I was treated the same as the men, or the, you know, the women went out to smoke like the men did. Women were quite happy getting divorces quite often. And this made the US anxious.
Okay, so we now know from what you've told us about the book that there are patriarchy is not a naturally occurring phenomenon. There are other ways of organising your society, that nation states can choose to adopt policies that undermine elements of patriarchy. So how come this isn't all fixed yet?
Well, I could ask you that, Julia.
You first.
Well, the thing, it's within our control, but, you know, in the later chapters, I wrote a chapter about the Iranian Revolution. It was the last chapter in the book. I wrote it before the current protests, so I couldn't anticipate what would happen. I don't think many people did. But what we see is that in the 1979 revolution in Iran, everyone was part of that. That was a popular revolution. It wasn't just religious conservatives. It was women's rights activists. It was socialists. It was everyone. Why is it that they didn't get what they wanted out of that revolution? Why was the Shah deposed and then they ended up with an even more conservative regime than they had before? And this is kind of what we need to interrogate. What alternatives have we actually created to the worlds that we have now? How willing are we to step beyond our imaginations? What is holding us back? And often, you know, it's things as mundane as tradition and culture and religion. And people have always done things this way.
And how much as...
Oh, you didn't answer the question.
No. Benefit of being the interviewer. We'll come back to that, but I do want to... see what I did there? I do want to draw you out on and questions of tradition holding this up. How much of a role do women play in reinforcing that? In the book, you talk, you know, very persuasively about how, because these things are seen as the way everything's always been, because young women in particular often have a very difficult position in the hierarchy, and the position of women changes and gets better when they're older. So, for example, the young new bride who goes to live with her husband's family and is seen to have obligations to the care of the whole family, when she becomes the older woman, she is quite looking forward to having her son's new bride be the one who picks up the domestic labour. I mean, how much have women either internalised that this is the natural order of things, or have sustained it because at least it's given them at some part of their lives something that they identify as valuable?
This was one of the hardest parts of writing this, because we don't want to feel that as women we would ever do anything to harm other women or undermine the agency of other women. But in reality, we have to still, as individuals, do the best that we can for ourselves. And that's really what it comes down to. So what you just described, that kind of mother-in-law, daughter-in-law power dynamic, which you often see in Asia, Middle East, parts of Africa, in patrilocal societies in which women often will leave their childhood families, the safety of their childhood families, to live with what in some cases can be little more than strangers. And in the worst cases, in cases of forced marriage or child marriage, can be an incredibly vulnerable situation in which you become subservient to this family that you've just entered. In fact, forced marriage and child marriage is now, under the International Labour Organization, only recently categorized as a form of slavery. So now in those slavery figures, marriage of that kind is included. So you get this power differential. Why do women then, within those families, allow those daughter-in-laws to be treated that way? Well, this is something that researcher Denise Candiotti in the 1980s described as a patriarchal bargain. That it's not that they're cruel, it's not that they don't care, it's that if you're in that vulnerable state, you do the best that you can, knowing that if you have a son and one day you're older and he gets married, then you will be the mother-in-law and then you will have the power in that family. Then you will have authority. In fact, the sociologist Fatima Mernissi, Moroccan sociologist in the 1970s, was carrying out research into traditional families in Morocco. And what she found was that in many of these families, the daughter-in-law would have to call the mother-in-law mistress, Lala, mistress, and kiss her hand. She would have to be, you know, openly obedient to her. But knowing that one day she would be the one that would be getting that power back. And we see that in lots of different ways, lots of small ways and big ways. Ask yourself honestly, all of us here, in what ways do we not question, you know, some of the things that we do because we know that it gives us some short-term benefit or even long-term benefit to make that choice, knowing that it may not be the best for society in the long run. Even as simple as taking your husband's name when you get married, which I'm not condemning at all, but that is a tradition without a doubt rooted in patriarchal, almost slave ownership, because slaves, when they joined their master's home, would be subsumed under their master's identity, so they would be given the same name. That is where that tradition comes from. And yet, I know women in my own family, I'm not condemning again, but when we, you know, subconsciously just keep going, you know, just keep doing things because they've been done this way, out of tradition, for whatever reason, in small and big ways, we just keep that alive. And I know it's hard, because that kind of wholesale change isn't going to happen overnight. We have to make the best of it. So without, you know, blaming victims, I understand. We each have to make the best of it. And sometimes you reach to other forms of power, systems of power, which is why, you know, conservative women movements, they gain a lot of power by aligning themselves with conservative men, because then, you know, if they can't get power this way, they'll get it that way. Mm. And the same you see, you know, in white feminism, or you see it in so many different walks of life, but we don't interrogate that. We don't want to.
I think that's absolutely right, and it's put very powerfully in the book. And another thing that is really brought out in the book is the stereotyping of how much we have absorbed, and even sometimes in our feminist rhetoric have absorbed, the stereotyping of what women are like. So, you know, women are the nurturing ones, women are the ones who care about others. You talk in the book about the woman who inherently, because she believes it's her role, takes the smaller and, you know, least appetising part of a shared dish because, you know, and if you you talk in the book, it's not... She would not say, oh, I am relegated to taking that piece. Tradition requires me to take that piece. She would actually say, I want to take the smaller, least appetising piece because, you know, I am a nurturing person and this is who I am and this is how I care for others. And there we've often, in the feminist movement, actually inculcated a bit of that with the expectation that women are always going to be the ones who put others in front of self. We expect women leaders not only to be strong but to be empathetic. We mark them down if they don't show these characteristics that we think women should show. And so we end up trapping ourselves back in stereotypes of who we should be. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit about how you put that in the book?
I'd be fascinated to know your views on that. Because Australia in particular is known as a very sexist society, if you don't mind me saying.
I'm sure there are some Australians in the room.
I have reflected on why that is, but then have you seen that in your own work in politics?
Yeah, look, I'm always careful about this analysis about Australia, partly because I think it gives people the permission to look at my experiences in politics and then to cheerfully conclude to themselves, oh, it couldn't happen here, it's something to do with Australia. Mm-hmm. And the reality is it happens to women everywhere, mm-hmm. Women who are in the political realm, and it doesn't happen the same way everywhere. I mean, we've got a very intense and robust political culture, the way in which we have our parliamentary proceedings, question time, probably means there's more visible expression to a lot of these things than there might be in other political cultures. But those elements are still there. And a great way of looking at that is to look at globalised phenomenon like social media, where, you know, wherever you are in the world, it is true to say that women in public life will disproportionately get the abusive stuff, the violent stuff. Women from marginalised groups will get it even more than women generally. That analysis has been done here in the UK, and it shows absolutely that black women, women of colour in UK politics get more abuse than women generally, and women generally get more abuse than men. So I think, you know, right around the world, we are seeing some progress made in women taking greater roles in power structures, whether that be politics or business or any other. But there's this misogynistic underside that is still there. And there's the stereotyping, and the research is very clear on this, that a woman who simply exercises power and projects strength will not be viewed as the sort of leader people want, whereas a man who exercises power and simply projects strength will be. We're putting an extra burden on her shoulders. We want her to be empathetic and nurturing mm. too. And that's a very, you know, very mm. narrow tightrope, you know, strength mm. one side, empathy the mm. other. You go to one side, too strong, not likeable, people don't want to support you. You go off the other side, oh, look, she seems lovely, but she's obviously not got the backbone to lead. yeah, and this is the tightrope that women are trying to navigate every day.
Yeah, and I do think, you know, when during the pandemic, when people were looking at women leaders and how well they were doing, and I did think to myself, well, there have been women leaders in the past who have been quite ruthless and haven't been empathic. Are they not also women leaders? Mm. Was Margaret Thatcher not also a woman leader? Wasn't Indira Gandhi not also a woman leader? It's almost like we degender them. The only woman leaders are the ones who follow the stereotypes.
That's right. And it then means that we are only giving great political assent to the very small number of women leaders who pull off this mix. Mm. So I always refer to it as the she's amazing phenomena. And as soon as I hear that about a woman leader, my heart kind of sinks because I know that in a number of years' time, people will be saying, I used to think she was amazing, but then she did X, and you're like, oh, she did something completely human, and which, 99 out of 100 politicians would have done. Not too many politicians get recommended for sainthood, and there's a reason for that. So she's just done something unbelievably ordinary and predictable, and that's what's shoved her off the pedestal. Yeah. You know, the pedestal is a very worrying place to be. Mm-hmm. And so I think diversifying our images of women's leadership is also really important. And in the Not Now, Not Ever book about misogyny today, we talk about that. I'm going to ask you one more question, and while I'm doing that, I'm going to ask you to think of some really good questions, because we're going to come to audience questions now. I think a joining point between your book and Not Now, Not Ever is this question of misogyny and patriarchy and how these things are mutating today. Mm. In the misogyny book, we do look back. Mary Beard wrote a beautiful piece about the history of misogyny. We look at my political experience, but we also look at misogyny today and the way it's metastasising, including in the online environment, with incels, you know, toxic masculinity, the sense that Andrew Tate, the sense that to be a man is really defined by the domination of women. What do you think's driving that? Is that the backlash? Mm-hmm. What do you think it is?
Yeah, I do think there's a backlash element to it, that whenever you get this kind of social change, obviously there's a reactionary element to what happens next. But I also think that we need to better understand what draws people to movements like this. Why is it, I mean, if it wasn't Andrew Tate, it would be somebody else, but why is it that people, that young men in particular, find so much appealing about this message? And I think part of the reason is that we haven't built a good enough narrative about what a truly gender equal society would look like and how that would benefit everybody. Yes. Because it really would benefit everybody. Like I said, those early states, those early gendered states in which you see those first shoots of patriarchy were not very good for young men either. Young men would be offered up as fodder by those states to fight all the time. They had to live up to these masculine ideals. Life for women was terrible, but life for young men wasn't perfect either. And that has been a straitjacket that in heavily, rigidly patriarchal societies we have lived with for a long time. What Andrew Tate says is lean into that. And that is not the answer for these young men. What we should be saying is you can live how you want, live fairly, live in this wonderful, fair, equal society in which you can live that free life that really opens you up to not be bound by gender stereotypes, that allows you to be a stay-at-home dad and, you know, do all the other things that you might want to do, and that can be good for you, not worse for you. Mm. So it's that, maybe, you know, and I'm as much a part of, you know, movements to get more women and girls into science, to really fight for gender equality on every ground. But this is a conversation that needs to include everyone, men, women, non-binary people, everybody, to say a less gendered society, a society without gender oppression, without patriarchy, would be better for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I'm going to come and take some questions. I'd have to say, I'm looking a little bit into darkness, so I'm going to do my best if you wave a hand. And OK, we've got a couple here and a very energetic hand wave. I saw that through the gloom, so we'll go there after. So, yes, here, thank please.
You. Hi, Angela. Hi, Julia. Thank you for that. So we're here at the RI. Can you comment about the effects of patriarchy on science and particularly on modern academic research?
I think she probably can.
She might be the expert.
That's the subject of another book. Yeah, I mean, it's so profound. I think one thing we have to understand is that the development of modern Western science coincided with a set of very rigid ideas about men and women in European society. And that really set the groundwork for not just the science of human difference, but also how the establishment of science developed. So during the Enlightenment, there was this very clear guiding principle that men and women were two distinct almost breeds that had a suite of physical and psychological differences between them, and that women were suited to the domestic sphere, which again is an invention. That idea was invented in ancient Greece. It certainly wasn't universal. And even in ancient Athens was a very weird society in every possible way. You know, this is a very warped idea. It's interesting that that is what we borrowed. That's what modern states borrowed from. And that men were suited to the public sphere. And that's why the European scientific academies, as a matter of course from the beginning, did not admit women. Why many of the universities in Europe did not admit women. And that didn't really change until the middle of the 20th century for many of them. The Royal Society, I should say, didn't start admitting women as members, I think, in 1945. So that's within living memory for my parents, at least. So this cast a very long shadow. The patriarchal nature of society when modern science was developed still casts that shadow now.
Hi, my name's Marsha. I work in inclusion in the built environment. I've got about three questions, a million questions actually. So I'm going to, whilst I think about that, I'm going to take this opportunity to take a little selfie.
Well done.
Had to be done. I'm going to go with the capitalism question, actually, because you talked about how, you know, the socialist society was bringing in, you know, that sense of gender equality as part of socialism. To what extent is capitalism the problem?
Mm. Well, I would say, and I might be on the extreme end here, that as long as you have any form of oppression, including class oppression, then you don't fix society's problems at all. As long as there's any kind of inequality and there's any kind of form of oppression, then you can always borrow from that and create new ones. And that's what happened with gender depression. Gender depression borrowed from the institution of slavery, the development of marriage. If you see many of the laws around marriage until relatively recently, they included a woman, a wife did not have the rights to her own children. If she divorced, that those children went to her husband. She did not have the right to keep her own earnings. She didn't even have her own identity. You know, it's only relatively recently, and in fact, in some states, this is still true, that if a woman marries a man who is not a citizen of that country, her children do not automatically have her citizenship because she is seen to belong to his identity, not to her own. So there are so many parallels here. And what that tells us is that gender depression is not some kind of separate oppression from everything else. It is completely intertwined with all other forms of inequality. So as long as you have capitalism, I think you still have the same problems. And I'm not calling for an end to capitalism. We can do it better. But it's not, again, you know, it's not socialism or capitalism. Surely we can do something better.
Hey, big fan. I had a question about what you said around ancient societies needing to sort of force women to have children and force men to, you know, go to war. To what extent do you think that fixation with declining population, as we're seeing in the States now, mm-hmm. underpins the decisions we're seeing around, you know, limiting rights to abortion?
Well, we have to ask ourselves, why do states care about reproduction at all? Why is this an interest for the state? Why is it not a personal issue? And it comes back to that fundamental question that it is in the state's interest to keep birth rates up. You can see this. Whenever birth rates fall in any country in the world, people panic. People in power panic and start asking, what can we do next? In China, we've seen that they've ended the one-child policy. Women still aren't having enough kids, and so now they're providing incentives. In Hungary, birth rates have been falling. They offer financial incentives to families to have more children. So it's always been an interest of the state. Can we, you know, form a direct relationship between, you know, interest in abortion and what's happening with abortion legislation and this? I think we can in a loose way, but certainly in the US, this is driven by religious conservatives largely, who are in a minority. The majority of the country is not in favour of this very strict this very strict legislation. But I would argue then again, where do those religious ideas come from? And I think again, they were fed by the needs of those in power in those states at the time, possibly.
And yeah, I can see another hand. We'll go there and then we'll come across. Yes.
Yeah, thank you. I was really interested to hear what you said about gender equality in the Soviet Union. And I just wondered how that fits, or perhaps what conclusions can be drawn from the fact that despite that, the senior leadership of the Soviet Union were all men.
Yeah, and that was the big paradox. And that was, you know, you can see it all throughout the feminist literature on the Soviet Union, is that on the one hand, here was a regime committed to gender equality. On the other hand, even until the end, even into the 1980s, there were hardly any women in power in the Communist Party. And women still at home, you know, where there was domestic work to do, the state was really reluctant to get involved in that. As much as they promoted gender equality out there, outside the home, inside the home, you know, they kind of sided with the men. And we still see that in labour movements now, this kind of obsession with the working man. And this is part of the reason that we have sexism and racism in labour movements, is because, you know, that idea of the working man as being the central unit of the socialist state, I think, still hangs over us. But like I said, you know, there aren't just two 20th century models for us to draw on for future societies. We can do better than that.
I have a question, because a lot of what you talked about when we went through the discussion is primarily focused on the definition of sort of masculine and feminine. And I'm curious to hear about what you think, where we have such a broader definition of gender, including sort of non-binary, common, neutral, how potentially the patriarchy can evolve given this shift in gender norms.
Well, we do see, if you look cross-culturally, we don't, you know, gender norms are completely different depending on where you are in the world. And certainly the further back you go into history, then you see far more thinking and discussion about how differently in reality things are from how the state might want them to be. Even in antiquity, if you look in ancient Greek literature, there is this kind of hatred of women, this misogynistic hatred of women. Yet at the same time, you know, why do we have that? Why do you have to direct so much hate towards a system if it's natural, if this is how things are always meant to be? The hate is because we know this is not how things are by themselves. We have to kind of construct it this way. We have to push it in that direction in order to get exactly the kind of society that we want. And around, you know, intersex issues, transgender, I mean, I'm using modern day terms to describe what in antiquity would have been conceived very differently. But how do you imagine life outside the gender binary? Even then, there was this concern that people knew that people didn't fit into these categories very comfortably. How do we reconcile ourselves with that? How can we manipulate things in order to make it possible for people to fit more neatly into these categories? I'm so excited by what's happening now in terms of how we think about gender, because we are really revisiting a lot of that. We're seeing a lot of that kind of opening up, broadening out the way that we think about gender as this very rigid binary thing. And in the process, I think that is one of the most anti-patriarchal things we can do, because it fundamentally challenges that patriarchal state and its aims.
And you talk in the book too about ancient language and its the difference in the way that it looked at gender.
Yeah, it's in the
grammar.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, English is not as gendered a language as others. I was in Spain recently and it was a conference on science communication and gender. And one of the talks was about how difficult it is in Spain to have an inclusive conversation around women in STEM, because even the words for scientist are gendered. So if you use the plural, you will use the male plural even if there are women in the team. And it becomes really difficult after a while when every single thing is gendered. And I do think looking at those gendered histories of language can tell us something about the patriarchal histories of those places. And what's interesting is I was speaking to a scholar of Indo-European languages. So the Indo-European family of languages is many of the languages that are common in the world now, spoken by many of us. But they go back to a certain root, sometimes referred to as Proto-Indo-European. So the languages spoken before these languages came about. And in these early languages, there isn't gender in the same way. It emerges later. And that tells you something about how important gender became to those states in which those languages were spoken.
Mm. A question here, please.
Thank you for a brilliant talk, and thank you for your books. I truly wouldn't have gotten through my master's without them. So thank you. My question is about women leaders and women in power. It seems that women leaders in the most ascendant of positions tend to be more associated with the hard right or conservatism that is exclusionary. I say this as an American. and I wonder, that seems to me that it's a lever of patriarchy, but I'm not clever enough to figure out what's going on there.
Julia, you are so well placed.
I think there's various layers of what's going on. I mean, at the absolute top layer, if we're looping back to the conversation we had earlier, if we're going to free ourselves of gender stereotypes, then there's no reason to assume that a woman wouldn't believe, strongly personally believe, in hard right ideology. Now, obviously, I wouldn't agree with her, but she might genuinely have those beliefs in the same way that a very progressive woman might have a completely counter set of beliefs. And there's no reason at that level to say, well, overwhelmingly, women should be on this side of the political spectrum. We can say that at the top level. I think coming below that level and looking about the practice of contemporary politics and the populist movements around the world and the intersection between them and more authoritarian models of leadership, I think that a bit of game playing goes on where there's a counterintuitive appeal to having a spokesperson who doesn't fit the mode. So a hard right movement that has a female spokesperson is sort of, in some ways, through the presentation of that spokesperson, is undermining any critique that regime is not going to be good for women, or that mm-hmm. regime is old-fashioned or backwards-looking. And I think, people who don't fit the mode generate more media coverage because there's something intriguing about it. And so I think, in quite a knowing way, populist movements play with that and play with that in terms of who they promote as spokespeople. We see, for example, in the US, there's often a lot of frisson about the selection of an African-American to be a Republican candidate. You know, we all know from American politics that the African-American community disproportionately supports the Democrats. I think there's a bit of, political arbitrage with all of that when the Republicans are saying, well, you know, it's possible for African-American people to support us too. We've just selected X or Y or Z to be our representative in the following area. So I think there's a bit of, political manipulation sometimes that goes on too.
Hello. Hi. I want to go back to the beginning when you were talking. You spoke about matrilineal rule instead of the matriarchy, and I was wondering what, it's a very simple question, what is the difference? But also, I was wondering, in antiquity and ancient civilizations, was it an either-or situation? I know you mentioned one example of egalitarian populations, but was it either male or female-dominated?
Not at all. You see such a huge amount of social variation. And in fact, what's interesting about matrilineal societies that are still existing now is that everyone is different. Every single one is different. They have their own ways of organizing themselves. Some worship goddesses. Some have different systems of marriage. Maybe, they do marry, or sometimes they don't marry, and you can have multiple sexual partners. So there's so many different ways of organising yourself. And this is what makes patriarchy so particularly weird, is that it is one way, very, very, not homogeneous, but very kind of, in its underlying principles, quite common and consistent around the world, partly because of how it's been exported over thousands of years and, spread through certain ideologies and through empire and colonialism. But that one system should be the kind of one that we land on, that we naturalise, that we keep going back to. Is completely bizarre that we should do that. And even in the literature, when people study matrilineal societies, they will use the phrase again and again, the matrilineal puzzle. Why do these societies exist? When will they go extinct? Surely they will. There must be a certain set of factors here. They're looking for one reason, one thing, that will guarantee that can explain their existence in the first place. And a study was actually done by anthropologists not that long ago, I think within the last 10 years, where they looked at all these societies and looked at all these factors, and they couldn't find a common factor that could explain them or their decline. It was complicated, just like in the example I gave in Kerala. It depends on the circumstances, the politics around you, what's happening culturally, the way things are being framed. That is what precipitates social change. There are big factors as well. I don't want to say, you know, that this is all, we can't pin it down to everything. Patrilocality, I think, is a necessary condition of patriarchy. Without it, you just do not have that same level of vulnerability of women or men being able to form networks with each other because they happen to be related to each other. I think another necessary condition is states being interested in kind of the gendered setup of the societies within them. But then there are other things, there are other factors. And what's interesting is that in Kerala now, just recently, a number of schools introduced gender-neutral uniforms. And the way the state phrased that, the way they presented it to people, is we are returning to our traditions now. This is part of our tradition. And often we go back to tradition when we're trying to figure out how do we create a society that's authentic to us, that, you know, whose values we share. What's, you know, here is a society that used to be matrilineal, and they've gone back and said, this is actually our tradition, which just goes to prove that you can create your own traditions. It's really up to you.
Yes.
Matriarchal. Sorry, matrilineal means that property and name is passed from mother to daughter. Matriarchal means women hold all the authority. So, you know, these are simplistic terms. And there are people who argue, scholars who argue, that actually some of the matrilineal societies in existence today are matriarchal of a kind, because women do share authority with men. And that's often what you see, is that it's not that women have all the power and that makes it matriarchal, and men have all the power and that makes it patriarchal. There is a whole landscape in between in which, you know, power depends on the circumstances, that it can be shared in certain ways. And we are very unwilling, you know, because we have created such a binary way of looking at the world, to imagine that there could be a space in between.
Okay. Yes, please.
Thank you. Thank you very much for a brilliant talk, both of you. It's been really wonderful listening to you. In your book, Angela, was there any research that you came upon or that you developed yourself which looked at the younger generation, Gen Z or Z, as you'll now refer to it, being in New York, that shows that both their language and their awareness differs significantly from the generations that came before?
Well, again, this depends on where you live in the world. You know, it's so... There are these kind of gaping, we were talking about this earlier, these kind of gaping generational divides that can feel unsettling to both sides, particularly in this country right now. I think that, I don't know, Julia, do you have a perspective on this, on how differently people are thinking and what that says about gender?
I'm furiously trying to remember the name of it, and my colleague, Bobby Duffy, at the Policy Institute at King's College is going to kill me, but Bobby Duffy's authored a wonderful book about these generational divide questions, very research-based, and a bit like this book, it ends up being much more complicated than you think it's going to be. And so what he tries to break out is... Let me see if I can get this right. He tries to break out age-based effects. So to what extent have younger people always been slightly more progressive and disruptive than the societies of which they were members, but as they age, their views tended to more conform with the society. So sort of that flow effect versus what... crack points do you get in human history, which mean the generation coming after have a different view than the generation that went before. You know, you could say the generation pre-World War I had a different view of war than the generation that participated in World War I, that men, overwhelmingly men, came back from fighting with quite different views about warfare and their obligations to their nation state and the horrors of the experiences they'd been through. And then to what extent are there just, you know, looking at today's cohorts, are there genuine and trackable differences? And he finds that the patterns are very, very mixed, and it's certainly not true to simply say that the younger generation is more progressive than the older generation. And each year at the Global Institute for Women's Leadership at King's College, we put out research which we partner with Ipsos Mori, the very noted global polling company, and we're about to put out a new data set for International Women's Day next week. And we've asked a series of standard questions year after year so we can, you know, chase trend lines. And, you know, when we look at that, we often get outcomes in those questions which show much more conservative attitudes amongst younger people than a lot of the sort of social media commentary and campaigning by subsets of young people would lead you to believe.
Yeah, I've read Bobby's work. It's excellent on this. And we can see it historically. If you look before the Second World War, there were much higher rates of women in higher education in the US than there were after the Second World War. And part of the reason for that was that men had come back from war, the state had decided, well, we don't want women taking men's jobs anymore, we're going to go back to our founding ideology of women being domesticated. And again, the Cold War played a part in that. And so you see very high rates of marriage. You know, even though we think of America as being an individualistic society, people were very conformist in the 1950s. Most people would get married and most women would give up work after they got married and not go into higher education.
And for many societies, of course, that was a legislated norm, you know, that you, in Australia, in the Australian Public Service, you know, if you got married, you had to resign from the public service, for example. These were sort of legislated requirements. We've got a question here.
How are we going to educate the newer generation on the patriarchal society in science?
Oh. Well, that's the most adorable.
That was a younger generation voice.
Well, I studied engineering at university, and when I was at school, I was often one of the only girls in a lot of my classes because I was going down the engineering track. I was very lucky to be brought up in a family of sisters in which we were told we could do anything. And because my dad had been an engineer, I thought I could be an engineer as well. I didn't see any reason why not. And it was a huge shock to me to go out into the real world and realise that other families were not like my family. So I do think part of it starts at home, but also, you know, the patriarchy is tied up, or patriarchies are tied up in telling you what you can and can't do. When you do what you want to do, regardless of what anybody says, that is an anti-patriarchal act right there. So you choose what you want and you just go for it. And engineering, I have to say, is a very bankable career. It's a really good degree to have.
And you never know where it might lead. So we've got one right up in the stars, don't we?
Hi, I've never been described as a voice of God before. I wanted to ask a bit more about visibility and invisibility, actually, of both work and suffering. Because I suppose one of the things that modern feminists think is that a lot of the work women do, particularly in the home, is quite literally behind closed doors and not seen. I thought it was very interesting that when a legislative change meant Spanish men were now taking as long on paternity leave as their wives had on maternity leave, a lot of Spanish men reported they wanted fewer children. And then where I grew up, we had a total abortion ban. Thankfully, we overturned it in 2018. And having been really honoured to be part of that movement, I mean, one of the things we believed was that actually the silence and the shame was what maintained that status quo, that there was so much suffering, but it was so invisible. And even things like pain in childbirth was kind of seen as something that was not really, you couldn't talk about. And I suppose I just kind of really am curious about, I think we're probably all in agreement that that kind of invisibility of what women go through and what women do is part of the problem, but was it always that way?
No, of course, it wasn't always that way. And it's not that way for everyone, even now. Like I said, I grew up in a family in which my parents split everything down the middle. And in my family now, my husband does more of the childcare than I do. We do an equal amount of housework because we've designed it that way. And how do you make the invisible visible? You talk about it, you're open about it. I had to, you know, my husband did not grow up in the same circumstances as me. We had a lot of fights to get to where we are now. And I wouldn't stand for anything else. And I'm not saying that, you know, women are standing for the situations that they're in, but we have to be bold about being open about these circumstances. The root of the labour being done at home, being done by women and being invisible, again, has its roots in slavery. This idea that there is certain labour that by its nature is unpaid, that is not supposed to be remunerated because you are working for somebody, your labour belongs to somebody else. In this case, the wife's labour belongs to the husband. And we have to be able to reportion that. And it sometimes surprises me that sometimes I talk to women who are huge champions for gender equality out there in the workplace. But at home, or they'll go to their parents' home and they'll see their dad sitting there and their mum doing everything and not say a word. We have to be open about it and have those fights in every single one of our homes.
Thank you. You spoke about the role of biology and gender depression. I was wondering if you could speak about the role menstruation and having periods has had on gender depression.
This is not not something I've interrogated at length, I'm afraid. I mean, I'm sure, I know that there is shame surrounding menstruation in certain countries. So, for example, in Nepal, there are a number of deaths that happen, even though this practice has been outlawed, because women, young women are expected to leave the house and go and stay in a hut, which might be freezing cold during their period. In my own culture, there is this idea that women shouldn't cook while they're on their period because it's considered polluted and shameful. So there are, you know, part of how we culturally design a society around this idea that that person, that individual, is separate from the rest of us and needs to be separated because she is distinct, different, and polluted in some way, I think, is where these patriarchal beliefs about menstruation come in. And we can challenge that again. You know, that is already happening. Period campaigners, menstruation campaigners, being more open about how we refer to periods and being proud of talking about it and not being ashamed about it is one step towards that.
One thing I wanted to come back to at the end is it is a fantastic book to take us through time around the world to look at patriarchy in so many different manifestations. But you do at the end talk about the way in which human beings are, to use your phrase, capable of jumping onto a rainbow. And by that, it's a beautiful phrase, and you use it to mean that we are capable of embracing a new way of being, a new set of ideas, a new new strengthening of equality. So I wanted to end by saying, what's the message that you want to leave people with, the thing that they can do in their own lives which is going to help us jump to that rainbow?
You make me sound really new age. I want to reassure everyone.
I would not describe the book is the book is history, it's science, but that is a beautiful phrase. It's beautifully written.
Well, I do, you know, at the end of the day, what do systems of inequality do? They divide people deliberately. They alienate people from each other. Patriarchy in particular even alienates people within their own families. Daughters from parents, husbands from wives, sons from parents, daughters from parents. It's so pervasive, this, and insidious, the way that this all works. We are not going to overcome that by hating each other more, by creating even further divisions. The only way to really overcome it is to recognize the solidarity, the possibility for love. And again, I don't want to sound New Age or hippie, but it is that love that is really going to fix those bonds, to repair that feeling of alienation, that distance that we've created between each other. And, you know, as much as the politics of anger can get us very far, and I get angry sometimes, you know, in my politics, but it will not get us all the way to the society that we want to get to. The rest of that way is going to come through working together.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Thank you, Angela.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to dig deeper into this topic, you can get Angela's book via the link in the episode description. Remember to give us a rating and a review to let us know what you think, and to help more people discover the podcast. And to learn about other fascinating science topics, you can join our upcoming talks in person or online. Head to rigb.org to get tickets.